Hello everybody, Julian Charles here of themindrenewed.com, coming to you as usual from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. And welcome to the second of our movie review podcasts here at TMR. Many listeners will remember that last time we talked about the film The Brotherhood of the Bell, and it certainly is my intention here at the podcast to be talking about various films over the coming months. All films that will have something to do with themes that we cover at the podcast have been covering for several years. Now, as I say, it's the second one today, and on this special day, this particular film may not seem initially relevant to the kind of stuff we've been dealing with at TMR, but actually it is, as you will come to hear. We're going to be talking about the 1966 movie Batman, starring Adam West, that great movie, which certainly formative for me growing up in the 1970s and 80s. I love that film. But we're going to have a special discussion today, as this is a special day today. We are going to be talking about something that's probably not known to most people, and that is that there are, in fact, hidden messages within this film. It is, of course, a very well-made comic film, but maybe that's a bit misleading, because to say that is kind of a covering for the fact that there are these special messages from, well, secret symbolism, which we hopefully are going to uncover as we have a conversation with our good friends Mark Campbell in London and Frank Johnson over there in California. And hopefully we will bring our insights to bear upon this film, which I'm sure most people have seen before and love, but perhaps insights that you've never heard before. So welcome, gentlemen, to the programme. Good to speak to you for a second time on this series.
Hello, Julian. Nice to speak to you.
Good morning, Julian. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. So it's morning for you, Frank, and it's late afternoon for Mark and me.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we're going to speak about this film then, and I suppose really the first thing to ask, I'll start with you, Mark. I wonder if you could give us your general impressions of this movie, both having seen it recently and from your seeing it in the past.
I think I first saw it when I was a sort of teenager and enjoyed it, and I enjoyed the TV series very much. This is the third time I've watched it. And what struck me watching it recently, a few days ago, was it's a very tight story. It works. As we were sort of discussing before the podcast, the scenes do move you on. There's not a lot of padding. That said, towards the end, there's quite a lot of padding. There's a very long fight scene on top of the submarine they've got.
It's quite long.
It does go on. And the ending of the film, it does go on for quite a long time to resolve the whole issue of the dehydrating people.
Oh, yes.
That seems to take an age to do.
One thing I wondered about, that long fight sequence at the end of the film, I wondered if that was because they'd had fight sequences before in the film, but they hadn't had any of those sort of comic strip thwack bash words on the screen, which, of course, you know, we all know and love. But I suppose perhaps they thought, well, we've got to get plenty of those words in now in this fight, so maybe that's why it went on for such a long time. I don't know.
Well, according to, I've sort of done some research on it, and Adam West, who plays Batman, was very keen to do the film. His one stipulation was he wanted more time out of the Batman costume. So when you think about it, he spends quite a lot of time as Bruce Wayne. Mm. So when he's fighting as Bruce Wayne, you don't get any of those, but you only get the bop, splat, bop when he's actually Batman, which is at the end of the film. So there's lots of fight scenes previous to that.
Yes.
But because he's Bruce Wayne, you don't get those, so they're sort of consistent, I suppose, with the Batman.
That's excellent. You know, I'd not realised that, but that makes total sense. Yes.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, I was waiting for them to come, and they certainly do come at the end, yes.
Frank, your general impressions of the movie?
I think I must have seen this a few times, like, shown on television, and I always thought this was, like, a long episode, because I could have swore as a kid I seen one episode where they all teamed up together, you know, the Joker, Riddler, and Penguin, and Catwoman. Mm. And I swear I've seen this play out as a regular episode. So that's why when I saw this as a movie in my early 20s, I was like, oh, okay, so that's actually a real movie. And rewatching it again for this show, I think I enjoyed the TV series more, mainly because, like, each episode is kind of a tighter story. I mean, as much as there is one.
there is a story, yes.
No, there is. You know, the movie is fast paced, and I do feel like there's some scenes where it's like you know, they go out to the sea and try to find the yacht, and then they go back out to the sea like the next scene and get stuck to the buoy. It's like that could have been the same scene instead of going back. You know,
yeah, I guess what they're doing with that sort of thing is they have a gag that they want to do, and so they create a scene around the gag. And
yeah,
that's fair enough, because I mean that's.
I didn't think it would have been more efficient filmmaking to have them just. See the boat disappear, and then they go down and investigate the buoy. Yeah. And I don't know. I'm not a filmmaker, so what do I know? But overall, you know, it's entertaining. I had a few good laughs rewatching this. The performances were right on par with the TV series. All the actors were great.
Yes,
they played their roles as serious actors. You know, knowing they're in kind of a goofy movie, but great job.
Absolutely. I mean, I think loads of them are really very good. I mean, Adam West, I suppose, tops the bill. Because he is just, always thought his portrayal is absolutely brilliant. And I have to say that when the more serious Michael Keaton Batman film came out, was it in the 80s? I think it was. I was really, really disappointed. First of all, to find that it was played so seriously. And then secondly, to find that it wasn't Adam West. And I was horrified.
The same reaction my parents had as soon as that movie, the Michael Keaton one, came out. They're like, oh, this isn't the same. And then, like, because that Batman came out at the same time, the TV channels were playing the old Adam West ones, and so we'd watch those every day as a family. So that's maybe also why I have a better memory of the TV shows, because, you know, we used to watch both episodes every night when they'd play them.
Talking about the cast, as I said, that Adam West tops the bill, but actually I think perhaps he's rivaled by Governor Gordon, Neil Hamilton, who plays that sort of rigid-faced, ultra-serious governor. It's just incredible. Some of the most stupid things are said between the four of them in the governor's office, and he'll react with stony-faced seriousness. That's fantastic.
Yes. He never
deserves an Academy Award for that.
Exactly, yes.
He never once winks at the audience or does any kind of double take or anything, does he? He's fantastic.
Yes.
Consistently. Yeah, I mean, there is a real skill in that, that they all do. They all do. I think we shouldn't forget Burt Ward, who plays Robin, because I think he's exceptionally good. Takes the whole thing so incredibly enthusiastically. Gosh, Batman, and it's...
he is really good.
No sense he's playing it up for a child. It's great because you're sort of taken in on one level, aren't you, by everyone's playing it seriously. And then when you grow up a bit, you realize
but of course for the hidden messages, which we will discuss in a moment. But yeah, I mean, talking about how a child can be sucked into this experience very much, as I was with The Man from U.N.C.L.E., I have to say, which is a completely different subject, but nevertheless, I thought, you know, I was about 8 years old, and I thought, I want to be Napoleon Solo, you know. I actually showed this, my son came in, who's 3 years old, and he came into the lounge yesterday while I was watching it, and he was absolutely full of Batman, and I've actually recorded him saying something about his hopes for how the story is going to unfold. So I think I'll play some of that now. This is my son reacting to the Batman movie.
Right, what are we watching?
I don't know.
Is it Batman?
Yes, Batman.
And who do you think is going to win? Do you think it's going to be Batman and Robin, or do you think it's going to be the nasty criminals?
Robin and Batman.
They're going to win, are they? Yes. Is it a good film?
They won't win, will they?
What, the Penguin and that Catwoman? I don't think they're going to win. Do you think they're going to win?
No. They're not going to win, are they?
They're not going to win, no.
Robin, and Batman and Robin are going to win, aren't they?
I think they're going to win, yes. Yes.
I think Batman and Robin are going to win.
I think so, too.
All the nasty criminals are in the sea.
Who are in the sea?
The criminals,
yes.
And Robin and Batman. But Robin and Batman are still going to win.
I think they're still going to win.
Let's watch some more.
We'll watch some more.
Let's see and find out.
Yes, let's.
Turn it on then.
I will do.
Now.
I will.
Okay.
A couple of other things about these characters. I thought that the guy who plays the Riddler, Frank Gorshin, or Gorshin, I don't know, I thought he was really good as well. That sort of manic, possessed kind of expressions that he has. I thought he played that very well, too.
He was also, do you remember an episode of Star Trek, the original series? And there was a guy,
I think his half his face was white and half was black.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, that was him as well. He played a character in that. Let that be your last battlefield.
Okay.
I didn't know that.
Classic episode.
Okay.
Yeah, he's exceptionally good, isn't he? They all throw themselves around. They all put their heart and soul into it.
They do. And Cesar Romero, too. Yeah,
Cesar Romero, of course, didn't shave his moustache. He was very fond of his moustache, so he didn't shave that, so the makeup was applied over the top of his moustache.
Yes.
That was always something I never noticed as a kid. I never noticed Joker's moustache until I was a grown-up, and then I'm like, hey, he's got his moustache.
Yeah, I know. And Burgess Meredith, I mean, he's just exceptional, yes, in everything he does. He is such a class act. Have you seen Rocky, any of the Rocky films?
Yeah, I loved him as Mickey, Rocky's trainer. Yeah, he was great in those movies.
I don't hear no bell.
I just think he's so watchable, like sort of Ernest Borgnine or something. He's just immediately, yes, class.
Mm. And what about Lee Merriweather, Catwoman? How do you feel about her performance?
Okay.
Hmm.
She's not
the strongest of the characters, perhaps. But
well, no, she's just asked to be sexy and wear very tight clothing, and that's it, really. Not much else to say about that.
I think she did good. I remember in the TV show, it was always either her or Julie Newmar. No, Eartha Kitt was the one.
Yes.
Like African American, I think. And
yeah.
I remember seeing her as Catwoman more often. Mm. So for me, to see a different Catwoman. Because how often did she play Catwoman in the series? Do you guys remember?
Don't know.
I don't know.
I don't think she did. No, I think she just played Catwoman in the film, and she appeared in Batman, but as another character. I think what you said, the other people played Catwoman in the TV series, Eartha Kitt, and whoever it was you said before. No, I think she was only in the film because they couldn't get the original.
Oh, okay.
She's not the strongest character. She's not allowed to be as zany, perhaps, as the others.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, she's more toned down and more subtle of a villain than the rest. The other guys are, like, over the top, insane.
Yes.
She's the love interest, isn't she?
Yeah.
That's very true.
And her dual role as Miss Kitka, the Russian spy, was...
who Batman doesn't recognize.
Yeah,
she did that very well, actually.
Oh, yes.
I enjoyed that.
Almost a sort of serious moment, isn't it, when they're going out for these, going in a horse-drawn buggy and stuff and dancing and everything. It's almost inviting you to take it seriously.
Yes. And the Elvis song being sung in French was excellent.
Yes, yes. Very good. Very good.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's get into some of the detail of the movie then and some of our interpretations of this. I mean, I've been looking up some of these things by using three main resources. One is The Secret Doctrine by Madame Blavatsky, volume number 2, which I think I've actually referred to in conversation with Frank on a previous occasion when we were talking about Ancient Aliens. But I've also got a book here called The Rosicrucians, Their Rites and Mysteries by Hargreaves Jennings, which was published towards the end of the 19th century, and also the classic work on magic and religion by Sir James Frazer, The Golden Bough.
Oh, yeah.
So all those resources have been very useful in this. So I think people will be surprised to hear some of these revelations today. So let's start with the opening, which I thought was an excellent title sequence with all those different spotlights and people running around and those dedications on the wall and the music, the sort of dissonant jazz sound of the music by Nelson Riddle. And then we get to this yacht scene, which, of course, is absolutely brilliant with the shark and all the rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Any comments on those, chaps? I mean, I've got some hidden message in there that I want to bring out in a minute, but any observations about that first scene?
Well, it's a very good scene, isn't it? I noticed that the yacht is owned by Big Ben Distilleries. That company gets a mention a couple of times.
It does.
In there. Yes. Yeah, yeah. Now, if you rearrange the letters of Big Ben Distilleries, you come up with Tingled Bible Irises. Now, I think that's quite important because that gives the impression of the all-seeing eye, which is very important symbolically.
Mm.
You know, I think that that's what they're trying to say just underneath the surface here.
That's a really good catch. I hadn't even thought about rearranging the letters. That's mind-blowing.
Clearly, it's obvious that's what they meant.
Yeah. I mean, I hadn't noticed that either, but the all-seeing eye is something that I picked up a number of times in the symbology.
Yeah. I mean, perhaps you'd like to share what you found with the numerology aspect of it.
Yes, there is some numerology because they're in the Batcopter and they're going towards the yacht that's out at sea. And you will remember that as they fly by, they see various people waving at them.
Oh, yes.
There are young women exercising on the top of a roof. There are four policemen on the beat and they put their caps over the heart, you know, in deference to the dynamic duo.
Oh, yes.
And then there's a middle-aged couple having a picnic in the park. Mm. Now, you'll notice that there are eight women and one man on the rooftop, so that's the number nine. There are four policemen. There are two being this couple in the park. Mm-hmm. If you treat those numbers numerologically, as Madame Blavatsky does, that's 9 plus 4 plus 2 equals 15. And 15 is Batman's number. If you go to the website of Rosette Delacroix, I don't know how you say that, and I'll put links into the show notes, Batman's number is 15 and 5. And 5 is, in fact, you know, an occult number. So there is, which actually has to do with the all-seeing eye, because you've got the four corners of the base of the pyramid, and the fifth corner is where the all-seeing eye is. So there is something certainly being telegraphed there.
Mm. Since you're bringing up the numerology aspect of things, later on in the film, once Bruce Wayne is captured, they want to put him in chamber or room 17, which of course we know is like the occult number for Osiris and very big deal in. So suggesting that perhaps, you know, Bruce Wayne or Batman is also playing sort of an Osiris role.
Mm. Well, that certainly fits. I mean, I will explain more of this later, but I actually think the film is working on different levels. And one of those levels is that Batman is actually not quite the goody that he seems to be. I mean, he's obviously he's portrayed as being the great citizen and you know, the salvation of the world, you know, in this story. But actually, I think in this hidden hermetic sense, I think he's the opposite of that. So we'll come to that. Yeah, in due course. We move then through the press conference where Catwoman poses as this Russian journalist, Miss Kitka. And then it goes to the governor's office where we have, of course, Governor Gordon with his excellent performance and Chief O'Hara and Robin and Batman. And they're trying to work out a riddle. And I think Batman says something like, "It was very fishy on that ladder." And somebody else says, "Oh, that's the Penguin." And somebody says, "It happened at sea." And Robin says, "Sea for Catwoman." And Batman says, "An exploding shark was pulling my leg." And then someone says, "Oh, that's the Joker pulling your leg." And then O'Hara says, "A sinister riddle." That's the Riddler. And I just thought that, you know, we take that for granted, don't we, as just part of the amusement of the show, which it is.
Yes.
But I think also it's encouraging us as the audience to pay attention to the actual riddle of the whole film. The whole thing is a riddle for us to work out.
Yes.
And that's not something that we tend to do, certainly with a film like this. I mean, do you have any thoughts about that sort of riddle aspect of the whole film, Mark?
I had some thoughts, actually, because you mentioned, I think, already you've got these four arch criminals. You have the Riddler, the Joker, Catwoman, the Penguin, and they call themselves United Underworld. I suppose the opposition of the UN, if you like.
Yes.
Now, United Underworld, if you rearrange the letters of that, you get, well, there's a couple of variations. I'm not sure which is the most accurate, but one of the rearrangements of it is intruded under owl, and the other one is dried unturned owl. Now, of course, that makes you think, well, most people might think of the Owl Shrine, which is, I don't know a lot about this, but it's in the Bohemian Grove cult. You have an enormous owl shrine, which people are said to worship. So I think that is quite key to what they're saying about these four arch criminals, that there is a link to the Bohemian Grove. I mean, does that make any kind of sense?
It might. Do you think they might be in opposition to the Bohemian Grove to tie into your theory about Batman being sort of a false figure? And these villains are actually trying to set us free from this Bohemian Grove.
Yes, turning everything on its head, right. And Batman is the arch enemy. Then these are actually, these four are the force for good.
I could see that. Since you bring up the Bohemian Grove, I think that's definitely a possibility because, you know, I actually went to the John Muir Forest near San Francisco. They actually have a little plaque there in the forest that tells about the origins of Bohemian Grove and that it started out as a bunch of sort of a social network for actors, and they moved out of the John Muir Woods into wherever they're at now with Bohemian Grove, probably when they decided to start undertaking the rituals and doing the owl thing. So perhaps this tie-in, you know, with these actors and these villains acting against these ruling elites is definitely a possibility.
Well, if I mean, you've got intruded under Owl, so you know they are intruding into the Bohemian Grove, so they are in opposition to that, aren't they? They are actually.
I think so.
They are. If you take that as a metaphor, they're actually undermining the owl symbolism and what it represents.
Yes, and then add to that, they're using a sea animal as opposed to the air animal of the owl for their symbol. And how, there's multiple arms of the octopus, so that's superior to the owl.
So this is very much the sort of Aleister Crowley thing, isn't it? Of turning everything on its head. Everything is the opposite of what it seems to be. I mean, when you see that scene, first when you see the United Underworld, you see the Joker there in the room, and you see the other criminals there, and you have that emblem on the wall where it says United Underworld, today Gotham City, tomorrow the world. On the surface... you're supposed to think these are the bad guys. That immediately, to anybody who has a more illuminated way of looking at things, it should alert you to the fact that, well, actually, maybe that's not all that it seems to be. And what I notice is that only a few scenes later, we have a scene in the governor's office where we have the four supposedly good guys, that's Batman, Robin, Chief O'Hara, and Governor Gordon, and they're all, again, thinking through what they're going to do. But they do a kind of dance as they're talking things through. They pass by each other. They actually have a cross formation with one person, as it were, sort of against each wall, and they pass by each other, and they trace out the shape of a cross as they shift positions as they're talking, which, of course, immediately makes me think of the cross of the Rosicrucians, the Rosy Cross. So I think what's being telegraphed there is that secretly they are, in fact, part of a nefarious secret society. We may think they look like the good guys. So if they're, in fact, part of a nefarious secret society, then the underworld are, in fact, the good guys, as you have both been saying, trying to get underneath. The owl of the Bohemian Grove and all that represents.
And the dried, unturned owl. I mean, possibly they are trying to turn the owl.
Yes.
So not only undermine it, but turn it to face the opposite way and let it represent something completely opposite to what it does at the moment.
I think, too, when you look at the four villains they chose for this movie, because the TV show had quite a few other villains that they used. Why did they choose these four?
Yes.
Obviously, they chose Joker and Riddler because those two definitely personify, creative, out-of-the-box thinking, which the ruling elite absolutely opposed to.
Absolutely. And, of course, that's what Batman exudes, doesn't he? He exudes this acceptance of the status quo. He's very much a statist, isn't he? And yet we have the Joker who represents Cuba, the Riddler who represents intellect. We have the Penguin who represents nature, the created order. We have Catwoman who represents, independent thought. So I think there are a lot of very positive things about those four supposed supervillains who are chosen. Can I come back to the numerology thing? The number five keeps on and on coming up in this film.
Oh, yes.
Which, of course, as I say, connotes the pyramid with the all-seeing eye. We have the five guinea pigs, they're called, five pirates who work for the underworld organization. And when they actually come in, they're numbered GP number one, GP number two, right up to five. So we have five characters again.
And, of course, what's interesting there is that Penguin, when he's scooping them up to put into those little test tubes, it's Penguin who says, every one of them has a mother. He's actually showing some care and attention. Whereas when they materialize in the Batcave, Batman and Robin just dispatch them, don't they?
Yes.
Without any thought. Yeah. They just punch them and they disappear because they've been reconstituted with heavy water, if you remember.
Yes, I remember.
I do remember, yes.
Can I throw in something here? And I don't know what to make of it. I thought you guys might have an idea. The bat phone, or is it the bat button to go down to the bat cave, is inside the bust of William Shakespeare.
You're right, yes.
Yeah. Now, what does that mean about the whole nature of Shakespeare literature and Batman and Robin, who we now establish as representing criminality, I suppose? Is there a link?
Well, there is a conspiracy, isn't there, about whether Shakespeare, in inverted commas, ever wrote Shakespeare's plays. Maybe somebody else wrote them. Francis Bacon or something may have written them. So maybe that's a reference to that.
I think definitely Shakespeare is held up by population at large as like the gold standard of English literature and performing arts. He's kind of held up in this almost godlike pedestal, of being like the standard by which everything else is kind of measured or derives from. And I think by tying Batman and Robin to Shakespeare, they're trying to say that, you know, these guys are the gold standard. They're the ruling elites and maintaining the status quo, as you say, and not deviating from the popular worldview and trying to just maintain facade for as long as they can. That's what I would take from that.
Yeah.
Well, I think people will be picking up just how much there is in this film that you will never have thought of before. There's so much symbolism in here.
Oh, yeah.
One of my favorite sequences is the bomb sequence, and that is actually packed full of numerology. I mean, the times when I've seen it in the past before, as I say, going to these reference works that I've consulted for the show, and when I'd seen it in the past, you know, I thought it was absolutely, and it is hilarious where he's trying to get rid of this bomb and he keeps on seeing these different characters and he can't throw the bomb there because he might kill, you know, a bunch of ducks or something. It's absolutely excellent. But if you go through very carefully, first of all, there's this Salvation Army band composed of three people. There's the number three. Then there are some ladies at a table, and there's the number two. There are two, two ladies. Then there are two nuns. There's a baby with its mother. That's two persons. There are two men at the quay. You have the Salvation Army again. That's three people. There are three people in the boat. There's a couple in the boat. That's two again. Now, two and three, it makes five. And what do we find at the end of that sequence? Five ducks. So yet again.
Yeah. Once you brought up the number five earlier, I knew you would say that there was five ducks. I didn't actually count the ducks. I should have.
There are five ducks.
I'm not surprised to hear that, actually.
Which, again, is the number of Batman. Interesting. And which is the number of the pyramid with the all-seeing eyes. So it all does tie up.
Very interesting.
And while we're on that, do you remember there's a one of these Polaris missiles is set off by the Riddler?
Yeah.
And it creates this message in the clouds, if you remember. And it says, how do you divide 17 apples among 16 people? Well, again, if you go to the works of Madame Blavatsky, you take 17, 1 plus 7 is 8. You take 16, 1 plus 6 is 7, 8 and 7 is 15. Again, that's the Batman number, 15 or 5.
Yes.
They're equivalent, apparently, in numerology.
Yes, yeah. Interesting.
And they've also mentioned the 17 there also, which, as I said earlier, is the Osiris number as well. Do you think any of those riddles they used have any sort of significance? Because I remember, what do you get when a turkey flies upside down, was it?
Oh, yes.
That was one of them, wasn't it? Yes. I did look into Madame Blavatsky's works for mentions of turkeys, but I didn't get very far.
I've heard it said that turkeys were kind of like interpreted as like a phoenix type of figure, which, as we know, phoenixes are very popular in Rosicrucianism and you know, that sort of quote-unquote enlightened thinking. So perhaps the turkey is like, you know, the villain saying, you know, we're going to rise from the ashes as like a phoenix rises from the ashes. You know, we're going to rise from the ashes of the New World Order.
It could be. Some of these symbols are more veiled, aren't they? They're not necessarily obvious.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, I've been thinking, as you've already established, the sort of tingled Bible iris, the all-seeing eye, the whole scene when they're next to the boy, or the buoy, as you pronounce it, Frank, I think. Although I noticed the pronunciation that was a bit odd in the film. Some people said buoy, some said boy. But anyway, the whole scene of them there, which is filmed, you can tell it's filmed in a tank, and you've got this backdrop of the sky, which you can see sort of creases in the sky, can't you? You can see where it's been hung up and the clouds. Now, that's interesting because that comes along many years before The Truman Show, which, you know, all about the nature of reality. And he got on a boat, didn't he? And he sort of set out, and the boat actually, I think, hit the edge of the studio, didn't it? And it goes back to the nature of reality and Shakespeare possibly not even existing. Other people wrote his plays. So it's all kind of linked together to the nature of reality. And then Batman, I think, at one point talks about characters have been reduced to antimatter due to the heavy water. So again, we're sort of dealing with opposites, aren't we? Opposites and lies and untruths.
Definitely a good catch.
And also one of the characters says they reverse the polarity. I've got that note written. Again, we're dealing with oppositions.
That scene on the buoy, they're reversing the polarity and then they run out of battery. The last torpedo was going to hit them because they ran out of their batteries, and so a porpoise sacrifices itself to save them from the last torpedo. And I'm wondering if there's any, there's got to be some significance with that. I haven't, you know, reviewed Madame Blavatsky's stuff with that, but
I think actually there is something of a paradox presented there. As we know, in Illuminist literature, paradox is rife. I think what we have there, you know, it's a why is it a porpoise? Well, I think it's very close to the word purpose. And I think what we're being asked here is, you know, what is the purpose in life? And we find that this porpoise apparently just by chance happens to come along and sacrifice itself. But actually, that's kind of the opposite of purposefulness, isn't it? That this just happens to come along by chance. So I think we're presented here with the death of purpose in the name of purpose.
Very interesting.
So I think, you know, it's very paradoxical at that point.
It died on porpoise, huh?
It died on porpoise, yeah. That's right.
Poipus. Yeah. Okay. So again, they're achieving it through humour, aren't they? They're making these points and they're doing it through humour. It's very clever.
Yes.
It is a very clever film. Yes, that's right.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, the dolphin spirit animal, if you look at sort of Native American Indians, I mean, it's set in America, so we have to be, perhaps should be looking at the Native American influence of this. The dolphin represents harmony and balance. So the death of porpoise, on purpose or not, is sort of disharmony, unbalance, isn't it?
Yes.
You know, if we've seen them as people who are represented as the good guys, but actually, just below the surface, they're the bad guys. I mean, their alter egos represent the capitalism system.
Yes.
He's a wealthy industrialist, is he not, with his young ward?
Absolutely. He does, in fact, describe himself as a capitalist as well, doesn't he, at some point in the film?
Yes, he does, yes.
Yes.
He says to Miss Kitka, capitalists like me carry large sums of money.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which he says to her from, I believe it's this chamber 17 that he was brought into.
Right.
Secret chamber.
Yeah. And is there any relevance in here to Moby Dick's coffee shop?
I did notice that yesterday. I wasn't able to pull any references from that.
Well, talking about Moby Dick, I mean, if you go back to that scene with the helicopter and the shark, you have an array of four oceanic spray repellent sprays, and one of them is a whale repellent spray.
Yes. Mm. Another one was manta ray spray and then shark repellent.
Yes.
What was the fourth one? Do you remember?
Barracuda.
Ah, barracuda, yes.
Yes. That's I like that because up until then you're thinking, well, that's ridiculous that they would have this bat spray. But when you realize there's more than one spray, you think, oh, okay, that makes sense. That makes sense. You know, it's too much of a coincidence if it's just the one thing.
Right. Yeah, sure.
Right. And in a helicopter of all places where the least likely place you would think
you'd be. Yes. Or perhaps they have them all over there, spread out all over their different bat vehicles. You never know.
They might.
So going back to the sort of the comic element of this, it is a fantastic scene, isn't it, where you know, he gets this shark stuck on his leg. And then and what I love about it is the fact that he goes on hitting it.
Yes.
Well, it takes a very long time for Robin to get this spray and climb slowly down all the time.
Yeah.
You can hear this thud of the hit.
Yes.
And then he's totally fine at the end. Wonderful.
And then Robin, instead of just handing it to him, he sort of hooks his legs over and then goes upside down to hand it to him.
But is that's very funny, but is that a message, you see? Is that upside down, you see? It's that sort of Aleister Crowley thing, isn't it? Of inverting things when he actually didn't need to do that.
Yeah.
Is he signalling something to us?
Did you count the rungs of the ladder? Because I didn't.
No.
I did not either.
I missed
could
that.
Tell us something.
Yeah. It could well be a very carefully chosen number.
I would bet it's probably 17 or 15.
Yeah.
I would almost bet it's probably 15 rungs on the ladder.
Well, let's just add to this more numerology, because the criminals, supposed criminals, go to the United World Building, don't they, to dehydrate all these members of the Security Council. And we find there are 9 members, 4 either side and 1 at the end equals 9. And what do we find then? That 9 is the number of man in the Book of Revelation, because we know that 666. If I go back to Madame Blavatsky, you take 666, use it 6 + 6 + 6 is 18, 1 + 8 = 9. So that's the number of man there. It's a very important symbolic number.
Yes.
It's saying, I think, that this United World meeting that's going on there looks like, oh, it's a great thing, but maybe there's something sinister about it. And I do think that does unfold towards the end of the film.
I agree,
It's very interesting, too, that they're all supposed to be working together to solve the world's problems, but they're all speaking their own language.
Yes.
As if they're all just kind of going their own way and doing their own thing, trying to get the others to fall in line with them instead of using some sort of common language.
Well, this is the key to the, Frank, this is absolutely the key to what happens at the end, because you'll remember that Batman and Robin reconstitute these people, don't they?
Yeah.
They say they're not going to tamper with nature, and they don't. But something goes wrong, and as they're reconstituted, they're rehydrated, they end up with the languages all confused.
Yeah.
Now, what I think is really key to remember about this is that this is what Batman and Robin have done. They have confused the languages of the United World.
Mm.
Now, that immediately brings up Babel, you know, in Genesis. The story of the Tower of Babel, where you have the confusion of languages, which, of course, is a judgment by God on humanity for its hubris. We know that that was overturned or put right, as it were, in the Book of Acts, you know, at the day of Pentecost, when the languages are united in the gospel.
Yeah.
So what do we see here? Batman and Robin undoing Pentecost and returning back to the confusion of languages of Babel. So what are they doing? I think, you know, I think they are creating a new world Babel order by doing this. To my mind, that is the keenest evidence that they are, in fact, of the pyramid. They are of the eye. They are of the new Babel world order, these two.
Yes.
A dynamic duo. Certainly they're dynamic, but they're dark characters, really.
Yes.
Yes. It's interesting how we have the dualism. Like they say, you know, Batman says they weren't going to mess with or alter anything.
Yes.
Ended up being messed with and altered anyways, even supposedly by accident. But I don't know. Maybe that's just a duality of Batman saying one thing and then doing another.
Yeah.
Part of the elite system.
Because, you know, Batman is responsible for rehydrating them. They make a great play of that at the end.
Yes.
He stands there with this hose pipe and it's all very sort of portentous and, you know, dramatic. And they are ready to rehydrate. Turn on the water faucet. You know, you have all this. I don't know quite where the test tubes and the props go, because when they pop up, it seems to all disappear. They've got, they're all little individual metal props, aren't they? The test tubes.
That's right, yeah.
And they all just vanish when they appear.
Well, willing suspense of disbelief there, Mark.
Okay, all right. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. I think you're supposed to look beyond that to the meanings, aren't you, really?
Yes, yes.
What do you think? Each one of those piles of dust is a different color also, even though they all kind of look similar. None of them really looks like they would turn into a red or blue pile of dust. Do you think that there would be some sort of symbolism with the colors there, you know? Maybe sort of something to do with the rainbow, because it's almost like a rainbow of colors, you know? Not only are they undoing the Babel thing, maybe they're looking to undo Noah's covenant after the flood, you know?
Good point.
We'd have to count the colors. There's another thing that I didn't think to do. There'd be seven colors, wouldn't there?
Yeah. I mean, they have to use water to rehydrate these rainbow-colored piles of dust, you know? So in a way, they're undoing, you know...
They're creating a rainbow in reverse.
Yes, yes.
Demolishing a... Well, yes, demolishing a rainbow.
Yeah, they're unmaking a rainbow.
Yes. Yeah, and is it any relevance that the Englishman at the end bangs his shoe on the desk?
Ah, there is.
Now, obviously, previously, it was the Russian who did it, because that was a reference to Khrushchev, wasn't it? The famous shoe banging on the desk, yes?
Right.
So what do we make of the English guy doing it at the end? Does he have the mind of a Russian?
Huh.
Not just the language.
Because this will be not long after Khrushchev's era, won't it?
Yes.
And people will know that. It'll be...
Yes, and of course you've got the president as well. They talk to the president, don't they? You see the back of the chair, you don't see him.
Before we get away from the Khrushchev and the shoe business, this is very important, because actually the hitting of the shoe connects to the rainbow, believe it or not. Well, if you look at the Rosicrucians, their rites and mysteries, you find on page 113 a mention of the horseshoe. Now, the horseshoe, of course, is a shoe, but it's also in the shape of a rainbow.
Oh.
And it says on page 113, the horseshoe is the mystic symbol of the wizard's foot.
Oh.
Okay.
And you know what? That's on page 113, which adds up to 5.
That's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's incredible.
Yeah. Incredible.
Yeah. The horseshoe is the mystic symbol of the wizard's foot, or the sigma, or sign of the abstract four-footed, the strangely secret, constantly presented, but as constantly evading magic meaning conveyed, in which a tremendous Kabbalistic sign we encounter everywhere. Interesting.
Wow.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
And of course, what's interesting is you see the back of the president, and he's stroking a cat or a dog? I can't remember now.
I could have sworn the first time they showed him, he's stroking a cat, and I immediately thought of Blofeld from the Spawn movies.
Yes.
And then when they cut him again, it's like a beagle or something.
Yes, that's interesting, because you mentioned just now about the four-footed.
Right.
Yes.
I could have sworn he was stroking a cat the first time, and then later on he has, a beagle or some sort of dog next to him.
Right.
Perhaps they're trying to say that some sort of agency like Spectre or whatever Blofeld ran is kind of behind the US government as well.
Right.
Yes. Yeah, sure. Yes.
So by having different four-footed animals as a pet, it's drawing attention to the four-footedness rather than the the actual pet. Yes.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And, you know, it's very interesting. Yes, on that page 113, which, as you say, Frank, adds up to 5, it actually mentions the word bat as well, which is rather amazing.
Interesting. Yeah.
Badge-like magic signs in the bodies of bats.
Excellent, yes.
And wild nocturnal creatures fixed upon barn doors we hold to be the perpetuation of the old heathen sacrifice to the harmful gods. Or a sort of devil propitiation. Again, in this horseshoe, we meet the horse. And it goes on about the horseshoe. So there's a connection between the bat and the horseshoe and the rainbow and four-footedness, all these things.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
So, you know, it seems quite a light-hearted film, but it's saying a heck of a lot just beneath the surface.
It is. But what does the end say? I mean, it actually says the end, but then it immediately says the living end, dot, 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 with a question mark.
I know.
What kind of dark saying is that? Any ideas?
I didn't even pick that up, actually.
Oh, I say.
I don't know. I don't know what to make of that. Online, there is a transcript of the film, which seems to be a camera transcript. It looks like an original transcript they would have used to make the film. And it doesn't have that at the end. It just says the end.
Ooh.
It has very detailed about everything else, but it just says the end caption. So when did they decide to make it the living end? And what does that mean? What does it mean, the living end?
I think maybe what it means is that the attempts of the quote-unquote villains of the movie have been stopped. And, you know, we're going to continue on living as we have always because, you know, Batman has maintained the order of the status quo. And, you know, it's going to be a living end because it's going to not really end. It's going to continue on.
Okay.
Yes, that is an interesting interpretation. I did wonder whether there was something to do with ever-livers in Rosicrucianism.
Okay.
People who, well, live forever. They're in our society. We don't know who they are. So I just wondered whether it's some reference to the living enders, you know, the ever-livers.
Oh, right.
Are Batman and Robin ever-livers? I don't know.
They seem to be because, I mean, Batman's been around since the 30s and, I mean, he hasn't aged.
No, he hasn't. That's true.
Interesting. The ending, you say that the living end, if you rearrange the letters of that, you come up with divine length.
Which is a reference to Osiris. Because
right.
The thing with Osiris is, you know, his member was...
right.
There's the whole thing of Osiris and his member.
Oh, okay.
Like, he was chopped up into tiny pieces and then, like, thrown into the Nile. And, like, the only thing that they couldn't put back together was his member, which is why the obelisk is, like, his thing, is, like, it's symbolic of his member.
Oh, okay.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, there's actually, I just pulled up the movie just as reference so I could see if the, what animal the president was stroking. But he's not stroking a cat. It's right. He has two beagles on a chair beside him.
Wonder what you're going to say then after talking about members. Right, okay. I really did. Okay.
I mean, this is
there's a lot in this film, Frank, isn't there? So he has two beagles. He does not have a cat.
No, the first time I saw a cat, but I wasn't like watching it super diligently. So
that's what you're supposed to think, aren't you? You've got the reference of this sort of guy behind a chair stroking an animal.
Right. I think if you're not paying attention, you're going to feel that it's Blofeld stroking a cat. And I think that's what they want you to think, is if you're not paying attention, that's what you're going to think and remember.
Yeah.
Because the Bond films will already have been started to be made by this point, won't they? So people will be familiar with them.
Yeah.
I mean, Dr. No, was it 62? Something like that.
Blofeld's first appearance was in the Thunderball novel from 1961.
For the novel, yes, okay.
Yeah, but the cat thing is from Russia with Love in 1963, Thunderball 1965, You Only Live Twice.
Okay. Of course, you've got Miss Kitka stroking her cat as well.
Yes.
Which leads to the fantastic scene where Batman protects the cat while he's having a fight. I think that's a wonderful scene.
Yes. Well, you like cats, don't you, Julian?
I do like cats.
Mm.
Yes, I want to see them protected. So.
Yes, good for you.
No, I just think it's a wonderful, you know, on the surface, his great citizenship that he would protect a cat and risk all, really, by just having one hand to fight with under those circumstances. Mm. Yeah. One of the reasons why people misunderstand him as being this great superhero, when in fact he's a super criminal.
Well, exactly. Yes.
Right, well, thank you both for coming back to talk about this fascinating film. Very, very amusing film. There's been lots of laughs amongst us, but, you know, it does have this serious element, this serious aspect to it that I did want to bring out between us, you know, on this special day. So thank you very much for uncovering, doing the research behind this to find this symbology and all these hidden meanings. And I hope that people will do their own research, not just accept what we say here, but, you know, go look at these kinds of works for themselves and perhaps look at the film one day with new eyes. So thank you very much, chaps, for coming on. It's been a great discussion.
You're welcome. Thanks, Julian.
Yes, thanks, Julian. This has been very illuminating. And I would encourage anybody who wants to share new insights into secret symbolism of this film to, you know, please share them with us on Facebook. If not on the Mind Renewed's page, you're welcome to do so in the Ancient Aliens Debunked Facebook group. We haven't been doing much there for a long time, but I definitely would welcome some discussion of the symbolism from the Batman movie there.
Mm. Absolutely. Can I encourage people then, if they do have some insights, to share those on the Ancient Aliens Debunked Facebook page?
Absolutely. It would be, I think it would be very good chance for iron to sharpen iron. Absolutely.
Mm. And I might well do one of my Bodorfest film reviews of Batman as well.
That would be great.
Oh, yeah.
So if anyone wants to check out those on the YouTube channel, Bodorfest film reviews.
Absolutely. Yes. When you've done that, I shall link to that particular production in the show notes.
Good. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you again. It's been great speaking to you two both. I don't know what we're going to do next time, but no doubt we'll come up with something equally interesting. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Now, United Underworld, what's interesting about that is if you rearrange the letters of that, you get in... Sorry. 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 shut up.
Oh, dear. Go on.
So what's interesting about that is if you rearrange the letters, you get... Well, there's a couple of variations. I'm not sure which is the most... accurate, but one of the rearrangements of it is intruded under owl, and the other one is I'm not sure what to make of this exactly, but dried unturned. I can't say it. sorry.
Oh dear.
sorry.